was the end of the workday, and a middle-aged man was leaving his work in downtown of a large city and got onto one of the city buses. And as he was there, of course, everybody else was going home too, so it was standing room only, packed in together. He was one of the strap hangers, you know. And a young man was pushed up against him, and the young man looked at him, seeing he had a watch, and he said, "Sir, can you tell me what time it is?" Well, this older fellow didn't respond. Didn't even acknowledge him. Wasn't even there. Next stop came, and the young man got off of his stop, at his stop, and others with him, as it was end of the day, many riding. And as the room was shuffled around then, another middle-aged man stood beside this man, a friend of this guy's, and he said, "What's wrong with you? Why are you so rude to the young guy? He just asked the time." And he said, "Well, if I'd have given him the time of day, he might have wanted to know where I was going. And he might have begun to share about our interests. And if we shared about our interests, he might have tried to invite himself to my house for dinner. And if he invited himself to my house for dinner, he'd have met my lovely daughter. And they would have fallen head over heels in love, and they'd have gotten married. And frankly, I don't want my daughter to marry a man who can't afford a watch." I mean, talking about seeing where step to step to step goes. But the man knew something, that knowing what time it is important. Any young person out there wanting to get married, buy a watch. Knowing what time it is important, because it's all about time. We live our lives, every moment of our lives, in time. Lifespans of nations are measured in centuries. Our lifespans, for many of us, are measured in decades. Our careers or educations are measured in years. Our yearly seasons are measured in months. Our vacations are measured in weeks. Our body's cycles are measured in days. Our travel is measured in hours, 2 hours to Louisville, 3 hours to Chicago. Our heart rates are measured in beats per minute. And our decisions and our actions are often made within a second's notice. We live by the hourglass. There is in my office this large hourglass that Joyce bought for me, and it is actually an hourglass. I've timed it more than a few times just to be sure. I didn't sit there and watch it all during the time, but I started it and then I stopped at the end and checked it out. It's an hour. And you know how hourglasses work. There's enough sand in there that with the gravity that pulls and the aperture between the top and the bottom of this hourglass, the granules fall. And the seconds pass. And pretty soon there are minutes piled on the bottom. And when it's all done and the top is empty, you just turn it over and start it again. Unfortunately, though, outside the hourglass, we don't have that luxury. We can't just turn it over and start it again. Time passes, never to be recaptured or recycled. And it passes at a steady rate. The grains of sand never vary unless your hourglass is dirty and doesn't work properly. We can't slow down time when we're having a wonderful moment. We can't speed up time when we are bored or tired or hurting. Time passes. We live our lives in time. We live our lives in seasons. You know, we have the seasons of the year. Spring, summer, fall, winter. We also have other seasons in our lives. You know, as we think about our ages, we move from one season to another. From birth to the mid-late teens, we are on our first season, the season of wonder, wondering. There are more oohs and ahs spoken by each of us in that first season than all the other seasons of our lives together, because we are seeing for the first time many times all these wonderful, strange things in this new experience we've never had before. We move from that first season of our lives of wondering to the season of wandering in our late teens through our 20s as we try to find out what the world's really like, and we wander around trying to find ourselves and our place in it. We move to our 30s and 40s. We enter the season of acquiring and aspiring. We aspire to all kinds of things, but we also aspire to acquire. I want to have the things that I've been told make me a symbol of success. And so I spend that energy aspiring to be somebody and to get the things that show my success. And then as we move through life, we move from that season of aspiring and acquiring to our 50s and our 60s, where we begin to refrain and maintain. I begin to refrain from the things that I did in my 30s and my 40s that I knew were not quite wise. Some of those things I don't do anymore because my body tells my mind, good luck, I'm not doing this. We begin to maintain, trying to keep up the things that we have, that we spent our time acquiring, to hold on to our lifestyles. Then for many of us, after the age of 70, we begin to enter a season of resting and divesting. So finally, we are not tethered to the expectations of others, to a time clock, and we're free to do the things we want to do without all the outside expectations. And we begin to simplify our lives and begin to let go of some of the things we worked so hard to acquire, to divest ourselves of those things. And then when it comes time to die, we enter a season of ending and beginning again. Over the next several weeks, we'll be celebrating the seasons of our lives, both as individuals and as Fishers United Methodist Church together, looking at the various times of our history, glancing at moments in the past that have helped us to come to the moment we are today, and moving forward to what we will be in the future in the different seasons of God's time in our lives. And to bring that to a completion in this series, we'll have that all-church celebration service on the 30th. Well, I'd like you to see the scripture this morning. So, Troy, if you're able to, would you put it up for me? King Solomon, known as the wisest man who ever lived, wrote these words about time and how our lives are lived in time, in the seasons of our lives. Excuse me. Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8. For everything there's a season, a time for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to harvest, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build up, a time to cry and a time to laugh, a time to grieve and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to turn away, a time to search and a time to quit searching, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to mend, a time to be quiet and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And Solomon was right. There is a season for everything we experience in our lifetimes. And while we're caught in the midst of those seasons, sometimes it's hard to see how those seasons all fit together, especially the painful ones, how they fit together to become a part of a grander picture of art that we can celebrate. And because they all fit together, we can celebrate every season of our lives, even those that we wouldn't choose and that bring pain. I'm going to go through some of the seasons and share a little bit about our experiences there this morning. There's a season in our lives for building up. Max Lucado, the gifted wordsmith, as he writes from the heart, I believe almost the heart of God, but his wonderful things, writes a story about two people. And he says this: a little boy is on the beach. On his knees, he scoops and packs the sand with plastic shovels into a bright red bucket. He upends the bucket on the surface and lifts it, and to his delight, the little architect has created a castle tower. All afternoon he'll work. He's spooning out the moat around the castle. Bottle tops become sentries, popsicle sticks become bridges, and a sand castle is built. He changes the scene then, and he says, big city, busy streets, rumbling traffic. Man in his office at his desk shuffles papers into stacks and delegates assignments. cradles a thorn on his shoulder and punches the keyboard with his fingers. Numbers are juggled, contracts are signed, and much to the delight of the man, a profit is made. All his life he will work, formulating the plans, forecasting the future. Annuities will be centuries, and capital gains will be bridges, and an empire will be built. The two builders of two castles have much in common. They shape granules into grandeurs. They see nothing and make something. They're diligent and determined. For both, the tide will rise and the end will come. There's a season our lives for building up. There's a season in our lives for pain and grief. We would never choose that season, but it comes, and every one of us here already has experience with that in one way or another. To live is to know pain. To hope that a good day is a day without pain is not the right understanding, because it's not possible to have a day, as far as our lives wholly live, without pain. It comes to all of us. We wouldn't choose it, but as it comes, it has something to offer us too. Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg was invited to give the commencement address at UC Berkeley. And as she got up there, she didn't dish out the standard, simplistic, happy thoughts, the pep talk for all the graduating seniors. Instead, she didn't say, "What I've come to teach you what I've learned about living." She said, "I've come to teach you what I've learned about dying." You see, her husband, David, died suddenly and unexpectedly in 2015. And as she dealt with that, she begins to share with this university graduating seniors, "For many months after his death and many times since, I was swallowed up in the deep fog of grief, what I think of as the void, an emptiness that fills your heart, your lungs, constricts your ability to think or even to breathe. But I also learned that when life sucks you under, you can kick against the bottom, break the surface, and breathe again. I learned that in the face of the void, or in the face of any challenge, you can choose joy and meaning. The easy days ahead of you will be easy. Simply to say, it's the hard days, the times that challenge you to your very core, that will determine who you are. You'll be defined not just by what you achieve, but how you survive. The season of our life is a season of grief and pain. There's one we wouldn't choose, but it has the capacity to deepen us as we live all the other days of our lives. There's a time in our lives, a season to forgive and let go of our pain. Harder than many of us would think. We think forgiveness is a nice idea and should be done until it comes to my pain. Then I have a hard time letting go. There was a survey conducted recently of 200 married adults trying to understand the place and power of forgiveness in one's marriage relationship. How does it impact that? And also the impact it has upon our own personal well-being. The research suggests that there is a huge relationship between marriage satisfaction and the ability to forgive. In fact, it appears that as much as one-third of satisfaction in marriage stems from our capacity to forgive our spouse and ourselves. Not just in marriage, though, it's significantly related to our personal emotional distress, as forgiveness, the ability to forgive, went up in these individuals. They reported having fewer symptoms of depression, of anxiety, and fatigue. There's a season in our lives to forgive and let go of our pain, which is to bless the other, to let them up, to take my boot off of their neck on the ground. I owe you, I'll let you go. And to free us from carrying that other on our backs as we hold that grudge. There's a season for waiting, and it brings with it not just marking time. In her book entitled Now and Then, written about Henry Nouwen, author Lucy Shaw writes, "I'm an impatient, restless person. Slowing down and waiting seems like a waste of time. Yet waiting seems to be an inevitable part of the human condition." The subject of her book, Henry Nouwen, wrote these words, "Waiting is a period of learning. The longer we wait, the more we hear and learn about him for whom we are waiting." Eugene Peterson, who wrote the Message version of the Bible, it's not an actual translation, it is simply a paraphrase of the Bible, echoes Nouwen's sentiments as we read in Romans chapter 8. He writes these things. It says, "Waiting does not diminish us any more than waiting diminishes a pregnant mother. We are enlarged in the waiting. During a time of waiting, God is vibrantly at work within us." We don't choose the seasons of waiting, but they have a gift to give us when we enter them. There's a season in our lives for rest and renewal. That all sounds wonderful, but to do that, we've got to step away from everything else that we're doing, and we just simply can't do that because I find my identity and my meaning in being my busy person self that I am. A season of rest and renewal. On the paper on which I've put my manuscript, which is a standard letter-sized paper, there are 93 and a half square inches. Now, the standard margin that's used in business and in school is one-inch margins all the way around. So how do you suppose the percentage of the paper is taken up by the white space? Would you say 15% or 20%? Way off. It's 37.4% of the page is white space, just around the edges. And if you were to double space your text, which I don't, one day I will, if you were to double, but that costs too much paper. It's really long. One day, if you do a double space your text, you're going to be over half the paper will be empty. Now, some folks don't like the idea of being inefficient and don't want to waste that opportunity for the real estate for the text. And you'll see them crowd in. Text, just cram it in and take the borders out and just get it all there. But we need the white space to allow our eyes to focus. I don't know about you. Maybe it's not true of you. Maybe I'm just lazy and shallow. But if I get to an article I really want to read, and I see it all crammed in there like that in little print and no margins, I start, but it isn't important. I'll look for it in a different format. Or I'll let it go. That's why we have big print Bibles now. We need the space, the white space. We need the margins to be able to focus on the text. And margins have reality to them. We need the margins of space in our lives. Blank spaces on our calendars, Sabbath time. They can give us room to deepen our relationship with God and others. The margins interact with how we live, how we think, and how we act. There's a time for rest and renewal in our lives, to find the margins so we can focus on the text. There's a time to know ourselves and to know God. Bible scholar and pastor N.T. Wright tells a story about an archbishop who was hearing the confessions of sin from the different congregation members, and there were three teenage boys who were in line, and they came one after the other. And the first two took their turns, and they were confessing all kinds of ridiculous sins and terrible crimes, none of which they'd ever committed. They were just trying to pull a fast one, you know, on the archbishop. And he knew what they were doing, and so he played along for a while. When the first one was done and the second one, they finished their confessions. Before he gave them acts of penance to do, they ran away out of the church, just laughing all the way. The third of the three came to do his turn. And so he listened to the third young man, still with the same tongue-in-cheek kind of thing as he was listening to finish up their prank. And the young man told him all these things. And before the young man could get away, he stopped and said, "Wait a minute, you've confessed your sins. Now let me give you some acts of penance, contrition, in response." He says, "I want you to leave the booth, and I want you to walk up to the front of the sanctuary here. And above the altar, there's this large, beautiful painting of Jesus on the cross. He says, and I want you to go up there, and I want you to stare at that painting and look into his eyes. And I want you to say to him, 'You've done all that for me, and I don't care that much.' I want you to do it three times." So the young man got up out of his chair in the confessional, and he walked to the front of the sanctuary. I mean, after all, he did catch him fair and square. He hadn't gotten away, and so he went to fulfill his obligation. Stood at the very front before the chancel, and he looked up and saw this beautiful painting of Jesus on the cross with his eyes there, and looked him in the eye and said, "You've done all that for me, and I don't care all that much." He said it a second time, "You've done all that for me, and I don't care all that much." But he couldn't get it out the third time as he began to weep. And his body was racked in sobs. There's something about Jesus and the cross that's able to cross the boundaries of philosophical discussions and of explanations of how one thing happened this way or the other way, and somehow just simply grab hold. The archbishop who was telling the story said, "I know this story is true because I was that third young man. And when that love, that grabbed hold of me," he said, "once God grabs hold of you in that experience, you somehow have a sense that it's the love of God that will not let you go. We have seasons in our lives for knowing ourselves and God. And finally, there's a season in our lives to tear down and go home." You remember Lucado's story about the little boy and the businessman and the castles they built. Well, the story doesn't end there for Max. He goes on and writes and says, although they both build, that's where the similarities cease, for the boy sees the end while the man ignores it. He says, "Watch the boy as the dusk approaches. As the waves near his sand castle, the wise child jumps to his feet and begins to clap. There's no sorrow, no fear, no regret. He knew what happened. He's not surprised. And when the great breaker crashes into his castle and his masterpiece is sucked into the sea, the boy smiles. He smiles and picks up his tools, takes his father's hand, and goes home. The grown-up, however, our other builder, is not so wise. As the wave of years collapses on his castle, he's terrified. He hovers over his sandy monument to protect it. He blocks the waves from the walls that he's made. And salt water soaked and shivering, he snarls in defiance at the incoming tide, saying, 'It's my castle, you can't have it.' The ocean doesn't respond. Has no need to, because they both know to whom the sand belongs." I I don't know much about sandcastles, he writes. But children do. Watch them and learn. Go ahead and build. But build with a child's heart. And when the sun sets and the tide takes, applaud. Salute the process of life. Take your father's hand and go home. All the seasons of our lives are ours to be celebrated. But in order to do that, we have to know what time it is. We can get so caught up in the nonstop pace of the lives we set for ourselves. We can be those who revel in being busy. And it's interesting, the different generations. My generation loves to talk about how busy we are. And we can sit together in any kind of gathering place and I can one-up you. I can out-busy you and make myself feel more important. The younger generation now who are raising their children don't necessarily think in those terms, but they put themselves and they are so tremendously stretched by everything they choose to allow and provide for their children and their opportunities that they so legitimately are. I've had some very dear younger friends, and nowadays that includes a lot of people age-wise, who are never ever at home, who never breathe, who are fighting with picking up from one practice to something else, to homework, and the weekends are 8 ball games. It's just the way life is for these families. They're dear, dear people to me, and I watch them, and I sympathize with them, empathize with them. The struggle is that if we don't understand and can't see the times of our lives, we look back at them when they're done, and they're just a blur. So I want to invite you this morning as we begin this Seasons of Celebration series for the next several weeks to do something maybe that you don't usually do. I want you to build the margins and white spaces in your page. I want you to look closely. God is right there in the midst of everything you're doing, that you are called to do, that you must do, that you choose to do in your relations, responsibilities. Build your margins. God is with you in the text, but you'll find him in the margins. And when you are exhausted, or when you find a moment to breathe, look closely. To see him there, to seek that hand that reaches out to take yours, to carry you through until the day comes that he takes you home together.